Okay? So those of you who are having trouble, all you do, you know, I would just, there's other ways to write. And, you know, I'm not trying to cramp your style. Okay, but if you, you know, if you're wondering, for me this works, right? It's like giving a dog a bone. He just goes happy as a clam when I see something like this. All right, we have. You know, I give some other examples here. Again, this was 2 years ago during the election. Here's a good thesis statement. Again, you notice that these professionals tend to use this but construction. I like the although. I like the although because it's clearly it's the dependent clause, and I know the important ideas, and you put the important ideas in the main part of the sentence. The main part of the sentence is the independent clause, right? The group of words with a subject and verb that can stand alone, right? That's the, and that's just a signal that you know that's the main idea, because often you're talking about two ideas. You're sort of filling people in with information, but you're also making your argument. Your argument is always the important idea, okay? George Bush is an axe murderer. You may think that's important, but it's not in an essay about what you think about his presidency, because you're actually going to talk about whether it's good or bad, and that's the main idea. Little details like he's an axe murderer, you know, that just, right, that gets subordinated. This is something you might want, if you're having trouble, you probably want to sit down and read it over a couple of times until you sort of get the hang of it. If you've got a grammar book, you know, look up thesis statement in it, and you'll see. I'm not making this stuff up. I didn't invent it. I just looked it up and put it in here for you. Because I know I was not writing this way, and I couldn't figure out why I was getting B's, and this seemed to work pretty well for me. So I think it'll work for you, too. Well, here's another one. By the way, I suppose this was your title, your paper. What would the title be? Well, I have this little rule, which you'll get in the other sheet, okay, which I got from a book. Titles should be five words or less with a verbal idea, reflecting the thesis statement. Okay? So put this sentence into five words or fewer. What?
The key to
the 60s. Key to the 60s. Dylan, key to the 60s. Dylan, key to cultural changes. Okay? Key has kind of got a verbal tinge to it. It's not really a verb, but you kind of, you know, it opens things up. Okay? Dylan opens up. How's that? If you want to really, opens up. All right? So you can do it. And I get the message. And now, if your title is Dylan Doesn't Talk. See, that's not reflecting the main idea. It's an idea, but it's not the main idea. So the thesis is just sort of, it's there. It's not so easy to come up with these things. All right? Often you have to write the paper first, and you keep reworking this. This happens all the time. That's why you try and write the paper at least 2 days before it's due, not the day before. Okay, unless you're really slick at this. So you have time to notice, hey, I didn't really make the point until the last page. This happens all the time. I finally figured out what I'm talking about because I had to go back and reread. I didn't really understand that Boccaccio story. Okay. So if you make the point, and often the point comes up in your conclusion. Now, you can leave it in the conclusion and therefore expect me to be good and lost for 5 pages until I get to it. And you go, oh yeah, he's so brilliant. But that was a rather horrible experience getting here. Or you can take that main point off the last page and put it up on the first page. And go, hey, I got it. Here's what I'm talking about. And when I see that, if it, you know, if it's reasonably well done, you know, I just sort of go into a happy mood and sort of go, oh, this la-di-da right through the paper, and I'm happy, and you're happy, and the grade goes way up. All right? That's because I know what you're talking about. I'm not sitting there guessing until the last page. People don't want to guess. They want to be told right up front. Yeah.
Did you actually read that article?
Did I read this article? I probably did, but I don't remember it. Why? Why is he the key to the changes?
Did I look at his lyrics to figure that out?
You know, I don't. You know, it wasn't necessarily the lyrics so much, but Dylan maybe. People have different reactions to him, but and I'm not that into music. But in 1965, a bunch of my friends said we got tickets to hear this guy down in Newark, New Jersey, at the mosque. The previous guy that the previous week had been James Brown. So nobody went down there to this place, okay? And it was, and I got there, and we were like in the second row, and this guy comes out, I'd never heard of him, and he starts singing folk songs, and they're unbelievable. And it was just the most incredible thing I ever seen. Then he, and this was the year he made the transition, then he takes off the acoustic guitar, and he brought out the electronic stuff, and he just blew the whole place away. It's unbelievable. I was 15 years old. And he's singing like Desolation Row, and these songs that go on for 30 minutes. And I'd never heard them before, but my friends were kind of folkies. They were into guitar. And that was the last, you know, I'd seen him. And then, and he gave, you know, he's been giving concerts for 30, but that would be one reason, the transition from folk to rock. I mean, this was it. This is pre-Beatles. Well, it's just after the Beatles. The Beatles are there, so he's moving into to rock, right? But it's a, you know, it's a transition out of the world of Elvis into the world of the 60s, into social protest. So that would be the, you know, this was the civil rights era. And he was taking the protest songs, the Pete Seeger songs, and then putting them in the main rock and roll genre. Elvis Presley did not sing protest songs. Jailhouse Rock was not about being in jail. You know, you ain't nothing but a hound dog. I don't know what it's about, but it wasn't about the civil rights movement. All right? But Dylan was. Okay. Well, just to finish the story, he came through. He was here at Purdue a couple of years ago. I didn't see him, but about 5 years ago he was here. And my wife and I went to see him. Was it more than that? 2 years ago. 6 years ago?
Two.
Yeah, I missed him that time. But I was here. He was here about 6 years ago, too. And I saw that one. And we went, and we had the last row. Remember, I was in the first row at the Moss Theater. We're in the last row of Elliott Hall. And he was, it was like being in the first row. He was, you know, usually I can't stand Elliott Hall. It's like this big, vast desert. Okay? It's awful. Right? But he just blew the whole place away. And he started doing these songs, and he for once did a really good selection. And you realize he was the history of rock and roll. I mean, it was unbelievable. He started with, you know, electric versions of folk songs and just moved right through Beatles. And you realize which ones the Beatles had covered from him and Jimi Hendrix covering from Dylan. You know, and like Peter, Paul, and Mary were all strictly Dylan songs, you know, I mean, the good ones. And he was the history of music in America. It was pretty, we decided never to see him again because that was it. We'd peaked in our lives. We'd die happy. I didn't think it would come back. So, yeah, maybe you read that. How about John Kerry? You don't want to hear about him? This was a very hopeful article. It didn't seem to work out. Okay, but there's the thesis. He's never stronger than when his back is against the wall. All right, so you give three examples of when he's in a corner and he gets out of it. Now, it turned out that wasn't true. When those Swift Boat guys came after him, he sort of messed up for whatever reason. They didn't expose their lies, but... But that's a strong thesis. Again, they use the but form, and I kind of like you to put it in the although form so I can really tell. But you have two independent clauses, so I can't tell which one you think is the most important. Okay? Because they're both equal grammatically. They're both independent clauses. The important ideas should go in a big group of words with a verb. Unimportant ideas get turned into adjectives. Okay? If I said something like, old Bob Dylan is the key to understanding the social and cultural change, I wouldn't expect you to talk about how old he was very much. If you wrote an essay on his age after writing this sentence because you thought the word old was the most important thing, that would be a weird way of expressing it. If you think his age is the whole thing, you would rewrite the whole sentence. The man who made some cultural changes is incredibly old. Let me talk about the color of his skin. which some guy described when he was at Purdue. It was like the color of wet newsprint. I mean, he wears his makeup. He's a weird guy. Okay, no way around it. All right, so there's that. Now, what the other thing I sent you was on the project. So let's see if we can. We don't need this. So you can get this? It may got, you know, sometimes they just filter the whole thing, it got dumped into the junk. Okay, I'll try and send it again. So, I don't know what else to say. I mean, I don't make up this title. Okay, I just cut and paste it, so same one as the other. Anyway, here we go. I'm writing this out to be clear about the project assignment, right? The paper is where your attention goes, the final exam, but you need to do something. And then we had the feedback, so I rewrote it a bit, that thing that I handed out before, which Kelly helped me on, okay? And let me just add two comments, and we'll go to it in a minute. Well, let's look at it, and we'll come back to this. We're losing our Montaigne today. I think the main confusion about it seemed to me was that it was just called YouTube assignment, but I haven't got enough videos up there to make it interesting because I just ran out of gas. Okay, that's other stuff to do. So it's YouTube or First Lines assignment, but the rest is the same. Find five people, each watch a different video, and they should write something, fill in the blanks, get it to you. Okay, and if they do the, you know, if they're making the comments right on the YouTube comments site, right, then you can just email me the name, put, you know, give me the names of the people who did it, so, you know, I can go check. And if they're looking at the part two, if they're not posting on YouTube but just looking at the website, the First Lines website, then you want them to email you. You got five emails. Put a cover letter where you talk a little bit about that should be stapled together, not stapled together. Okay. And hand it in on the last day of class. I can't get more clear than that. Is that right? Except, what? Is that clear enough?
That's
all right. Much too clear for my taste. So, so I say, if you want to do something else, that's fine. All right. Some people, I can't say that it's extra credit, but I'm an impressionable person, all right? So if you do something wonderful, I'll remember it, okay? If you want to edit one of the videos or recite something in class or do something else, that's fine too, all right? So some of you already had ideas, I know, for stuff. To download these videos, to edit them, you have to have QuickTime Pro. Not just QuickTime 7, but QuickTime Pro. It costs like $30. And it's not like instantly available on most of the Purdue machines, but I'm sure it's on a lot of them, or you can find it. But it does make it difficult. And I've been trying to get them to put it on my, I have it at home, but not here. And to get it put on my machine, it's now a week and a half, and they haven't done it. Okay, they've put a new version of QuickTime 7 on twice so far, but they haven't got the picture yet that I need QuickTime Pro. Okay. It's just a more advanced editor, right? So it allows these things. So what about extra credit? All right, because now I'm not a big extra credit guy, but you guys seem to just dying for extra credit. All right. So what I'm going to do is I will provide an extra credit opportunity on the final exam. How's that sound? All right. And I'm not sure the exact form that will take, but we have 2 hours there. And this unit, this Renaissance unit, isn't that long, so there'll be time for you to do some extra reading or answer an extra question or whatever, and hope that it helps you lift some grade or another. I can't get into points, all right? I'm not grading you on a point scale. I can just add 5 points, all right? But you know, if I see you've got something and you're borderline or something like that, say you got a B+ on a final paper or something like that. That would be the obvious thing. So you've got this little cushion, all right? there. If you got your, you know, if you know you got an A, you can walk out. Okay. All right. Is that clear enough? Okay. See, the extra credit is just what it means. You don't have to do it. So if it's too much, don't worry about it. And again, I'm changing when I'm talking like today. But now I'm running out of time. And adding pages. I'll put them. You know, they're going onto this the online website, right? So I'm tired of somehow the emails aren't working. But you can see that there's Tuesday. These are the pages I referred to. Okay, so and I'll put in a few more here for today. The next 2 days, we'll see. Okay, but when you're studying, I mean, it's sitting right there. It's sitting online. It's not a matter of email. So. I don't know what else to do.
Where's that at?
If you go, the easiest, it's, if you get that, if I ever get this email to you, you can click on it. But another way to get there, always with me, you can find most everything just by going to Bayardo. So let's get this up. You don't even need the dot com. See that? That's my little page. And then you can get to my home page from there. You can get the first lines and you can get to the home page. And then all my courses. Are you with me? And my God, there's your course. All right? And that's where you can find... Oh, I think I want to hear that Koran lecture again. That was so interesting. All right? Maybe, but now the problem is the quality of this is really... We're in the early days of the electronic revolution, as far as I can see. So, you may want to put the earphones on and have a technician. But it's there.
When the dust clears, particularly in England, the notion was that the average...
You may need a system like this, though, that you can crank up. Okay. Are you with me? This has been going on all semester. I thought you guys said. All right. Well, let's learn something. Let's do something new. Now you say to me, wait a minute. All your big talk about Chaucer. What you said on Tuesday doesn't jibe with that video. You said that Chaucer was kind of the big... beginnings of the Renaissance. He's the Dante and this corporate man and this focus on God is medieval, but we get this transition with that suddenly people are interested in character and the individual, separate people, and that's why we have the Canterbury Tales told by 29 separate pilgrims. Example of which is the Miller's Tale, which I only began. But I pointed out that it's got not just some young guys and a wayward wife who's going to have an affair with a student lodger, but we learn about what kind of woman she is. She's described. We sort of know about her thinking. We get into her interior. And this seems like a real Renaissance notion, this move from the corporate person to the individual. Okay? And you want to go back to that Miller's Tale. I'm not going to go over it again, but just quickly, this girl, Allison, is married to an old oaf, just like in the Boccaccio story. She's got a lodger, a student lodger, who's a student at Oxford, and decides he wants to seduce her. She's only 18. She's married to a guy who's like 60. All right? And Chaucer makes it more complicated than Boccaccio because Nicholas is the student, and he will, in fact, seduce her. But meanwhile, there's a priest in town, and he's got the hots for her, too. So he's trying to get into the house to seduce the wife, but she's trying to meet the boyfriend, and they're trying to get the husband out of the way. They put him in a bathtub up in the barn and convince him that the second flood is coming and that he needs to be prepared like Noah in the ark. Okay, so they got him hanging in a bathtub up in the barn while they're having an affair. But during the middle, while Nicholas is having his fun with Allison, the priest shows up at the window. All right, it's a rather scurvy tale, so I'm not going to go into it. But you can read it. But that seems to be about character. I mean, the character is an addition. Yeah, if you looked at that video, what was Anne, Professor Estelle, talking about? The Canterbury Tales. Why are they going to Canterbury? Why are these pilgrims going to Canterbury? And what does it mean? And she started getting very poetic. What? It was what?
I was
big party?
Yes.
Okay, it was a big party. But there was also a kind of religious overtone, wasn't it? They were going to Canterbury to the shrine of Thomas à Becket, the English martyr who was killed by Henry II. There was a struggle back in the 1100s between the church and the king who had the power to run things. And the archbishop was winning, so the king had him killed. All right, this is the plot of T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral. Right? But anyway, Becket became a saint, and he had a shrine at Canterbury, which is a city southeast of London, and about 26 miles away or so, I don't know exactly. And the pilgrims are walking there. But the Professor Estelle, who's a lay nun, she's perfect for this. She's actually leaving us for Notre Dame to go to the School of Theology. She started interpreting it. Oh, you have the birds singing, you have the zodiac signs. Don't you see how we're pulling the whole universe into this Canterbury pilgrimage? And that they're really, the pilgrimage to Canterbury is clearly symbolic of our pilgrimage through life. All right? That's the way she talks. And you're sort of seeking, just as we die, according to her, and go up to heaven. See, they're going to Canterbury, it's their heavenly home. And we say, hey, I've heard that before. Sounds like one of those interpretations of the Odyssey. You know, Odysseus' homecoming is sort of this coming back to it's this Platonic notion of, you know, that our souls come out of heaven, spend the time on earth, and then go back, right? And so we get these Platonic readings, and she's clearly doing that. And you say, well, if that's what the Canterbury Tales is about, that sounds really medieval. Sounds like Dante. Hell, purgatory, heaven, right? I thought that Chaucer was supposed to be more Renaissance, more concerned with the individual people. And I think that's right. So we have a paradox here. Okay? And in fact, C.S. Lewis wrote a very interesting and influential paper on this, noting that what's so odd about Chaucer is he doesn't modernize Boccaccio. He comes after Boccaccio. He doesn't modernize him. He actually medievalizes him. Okay? He not only develops character in a modern way, but he increases the religious element in the sort of more scurvy Italian Boccaccio, whose stories were printed in Playboy in the 60s as ribald tales from the classics, right? Are you following me on that? But it sets up the point that you can ask when you can write a paper, and certainly I can feel the exam essay question coming on me as I sit here, that it'll be something about the transition from the how would you describe the transition from the medieval period to the Renaissance period? Okay, and the answer is certainly this. There's a de-emphasis on religion, or there's an increase in skepticism in religion, and there's also an increase in emphasis on the individual as opposed to us all just being big cogs in this sort of machine of the universe, nameless people. And that was why I showed that statue of David, because it's just not a very medieval piece of art to just pick one guy and to put so much incredible intention on every detail of his anatomy. I mean, that really individualizes the guy. Every muscle, every nerve is important. Okay, I mean, Dante, we didn't do a lot of Dante, but you read it. But Dante doesn't stop, you know, in the middle of the inferno and says, you know, check out these abs. How my gun's looking. But Michelangelo would have been more concerned with that stuff, all right? So that's the point there. I had a couple other things I wanted to look at. Let's go to page 1896. Whoops, why isn't it there? Okay. I mentioned this guy before. Francis Petrarch. In the history of world literature, which is what this course is on, Florence, Italy produces three huge names. The three crowns of Italy, they call them. Dante, we've done some Dante. The third one's Boccaccio, but in between them there's this guy named Petrarch. Right? 1304 to 1374. And we ended the last period by looking at his ascent up Mont Ventoux on page 1901. Right? Where he goes up the mountain with his copy of St. Augustine. But instead of like going into the contemplative life and staring at the stars and thinking about ascending to heaven, he starts thinking about himself. This is really odd. It's a real transition. This is the break, right? Between Dante in the medieval period and Petrarch, who really focuses attention for the first time on the individual. Now you can... There are lots of counter-arguments to this, but I'll just stick with the big picture for this course, and I think that'll do it. He, besides doing this ascent, he wrote lots of letters. He was a literary guy. Okay, this was a new phenomenon, and a highly educated person. The church schools had become centers of education, and he's a product of this. So they know their Latin cold. They have Virgil memorized. They've read everything. Okay, don't forget, there's no films, there's no computer games. How many of you play computer games, by the way, just as a sidelight? You like them? And I just saw a thing on teaching chemistry through computer games. They did a project here. God, I think I had a grant for $500,000 for this. What a silly game that was. I mean, they managed to get hydrolysis in there, but at the cost of 5 minutes of guys sitting in what looked like dental chairs to me, you know, what giant machines came down on them and they shot back or something. The graphics are so bad, but I guess they're getting better. It's the future. When they do, I'll play them. Okay. Not till the, anyway. Petrarch, though, is different. He's read everything, and he's quite the artist. And he perfects a form of literature, which I want to talk about for the next few minutes, which is the lyric poem. Okay. We're going to get a number of names here in the next 10 or 12 minutes, 20 minutes. The lyric poem. Now, there were short lyrics in ancient Rome. In fact, they were excellent writers, with whom I didn't do. Catullus with his love poems. His greatest line was, "Give me 1,000 kisses, Lesbia. No, make it 100. If that's not erotic, I don't know what is. All right, but you think about it for a while. Okay, less is more, right? Okay, give me 1,000 kisses. No, give me 100. Right? Okay, never mind. Right, and the great Horace, who wrote these satires, just an absolutely brilliant guy who's famous, most famous poem, O Fons Banduzii, Splendidior Vitro, O Fountain of Banduzium, more crystalline than water. You know, I thirst for you, and everything like that. Okay, well, Petrarch takes this form, which had been circulating around, and there had been sonnets written before, but he really establishes the sonnet as the main thing. There had been a school of poetry in Sicily in 1250, and Dante and his friends wrote sonnets together. In fact, Dante wrote sonnets about Beatrice. Okay, some excellent sonnets. I mean, Dante was really weird. Yeah, I mean, his sonnets are like, "I had a dream, and the God Love came to me carrying a dead woman in his arms, dressed in red. And I looked at her, and I kissed her, and I fell down. You go, what the hell does that mean? And then he writes an explanation, okay, of it. This is a book of his called The Vita Nova. That was my encounter with love and death. I'm going to get into Dante. But Petrarch saw that stuff and said, seemed a little stilted to me. Okay, but I like the idea about writing about a woman. They seem odd, but Dante's sort of giving it some panache. Now, clearly Dante's not really interested in Beatrice. He's interested in his soul, in his beatitude. She's kind of symbolic. So symbolism is good. And Petrarch invents a woman for him to write about, and he calls her not Beatrice, but Laura. Laura. All right? And we have an example of the sonnets on page 1903. Okay? I mainly just want you to know the name Petrarch. The selection here happens to be really lousy, so I can't really make my points. But Laura was perfect for poetry because she represents so many things. All right, I've already spelled it. So there's her name, Laura, or in Italian, Laura. They would pronounce all the syllables. But, you know, and this being early medieval, he never gets close to her. She's way up on a pedestal. She disdains him. He's a louse. He's crawling. He's worshiping her from afar. Right, this is the origin of that notion of the woman on the pedestal. And really, it's Petrarch's invention. Okay, so you can't get anywhere near her, but occasionally, if you're downwind, you see, the little breeze passes over her, and you catch a little hint of it. Right? It hits your cheek. And it just so happens that in Italian, the breeze is the aura, the Laura. So whenever I talk about Laura, it's the breeze. Huh? That's pretty poetic stuff, okay? It's not that far from Beatrice and Beatitude, but it's, Dante's not, sensitivity's not as long as, anger is his big thing. Ah, well, what does she look like? Ah, she's magnificent. It may be that we live in Italy, where everybody has dark hair, but makeup is not unknown. Makeup is not unknown throughout history. I just heard a story of a woman opening beauty parlors in Afghanistan. Even when you've got that heavy burqa on, you want a decent perm underneath. It's true. Absolutely true. Okay, girls want to... This is something no guy understands, but girls want to put on the makeup and feel good. Anyway, so even though she's Italian, she has blonde hair. So you know it's out of a bottle, all right? But that doesn't matter. They had bleach they've had bleach since ancient Rome, okay? So she is the golden one, even though she's not a real blonde, but gold in Italian is oro, l'oro, Laura, very similar. So she's the golden one, okay? Well, it's also, she represents, she's not just the, she's the unattainable thing in Petrarch's life. But what's he really interested in? He's actually got a girlfriend and two illegitimate children in real life. Okay, because back then they just knocked up the servants and they were perfectly happy. So she represents the unattainable for him. You see? And what's he want more than anything else? He wants to be the greatest poet in the world. He wants to wear, right, the laurel wreath, right? That thing, remember when Daphne gets turned into a tree, she becomes the laurel tree? And Apollo's the god of poetry, she became the symbol of poetry. So even today we have a poet laureate, right? England has a poet laureate, America has one. So all that stuff's working in Petrarch. Now, unfortunately, there's not one of these poems that really... gets that across. They've picked all the religious poems. He sets this against the yearly cycle and the kind of resurrection motif. But there's one thing he sort of perfected, which you want, if you get anything out of an English class, you sort of want to know this little word, the oxymoron. You've heard of this in one of your classes? the oxymoron. Sharp and dull, I think, is what it means in Greek. But it's when you yoke two opposites together. It's an expression, a group of words, a trope, a metaphor that combines two opposites. Okay, and Petrarch, his normal state when he saw Laura was exactly like Romeo at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet. I'm on fire. I freeze. Okay? Same time. He's so torn, so trembling, okay, that you got these contradictory emotions. So a poetic line, I couldn't pull one out here, would be something like, I freeze with fire, I burn with ice. You get it? I freeze on fire. That's an oxymoron. Because you burn with fire, but so say you freeze is a figure of speech. But it seems to, attract him, right? So we get this idea, and these things were wildly popular, and in Italy there were hundreds and hundreds of poets who wrote these sonnets. Now a sonnet, do you see that word at the top of the page? You see it? Just means a little song. Like a cigarette is a little cigar, the E-T-T-E. Right? This is a sonnet from Suono. And Petrarch, if you count the lines, you'll notice on page 1903, they tend to have 14 lines. This is just a form. There is no universal cause for it, but it allows a short progression, a little, and it became a tradition. So, occasionally somebody write a sonnet with 15 lines, but everybody look at him like he's weird. Okay. In other words, it's an artificial constraint, and the game is can you make an interesting point in those 14 lines? All right? And it's got a definite rhyme scheme, which we don't need to go into. So let's turn now that we've done that to page 1916. And we'll do a little lesson in English poetry. The Renaissance that Petrarch begins in Italy in, say, 1360, 1370, doesn't really hit England for 200 years. England is very late. Right? We can see signs of it in Chaucer, but Chaucer is pretty medieval. The English court is still speaking French up to 1400, while in Italy they're writing in Italian. The 15th century is a mess. There were civil wars. Then Henry VIII comes in the 16th century, and he's so busy chopping off the heads of his wives, theme of a new movie, I think, the wives of Henry VIII, that poetry doesn't really get going until later in the century, at the time of Queen Elizabeth. Right? And the guys who get it going are, first of all, well, there's a bunch of them, but the one you probably haven't heard of is Edmund Spenser. He's on page 1916. He is generally ranked the number four English poet. Okay, we do some in English 240. You get to graduate school, you do a lot of them. He wrote a thing called The Faerie Queen. And he's a fabulous poet. He is unbelievable, but incredibly difficult. The Faerie Queen is based on a series of virtues. You don't need to know this, but it goes. One of the stanzas goes: the ways through which my weary steps I guide in this delightful land of Faerie are so exceedingly spacious and wide, and sprinkled with such sweet delights of all that pleasant is to ear and eye that I, nigh ravished with rare thoughts' delight, my tedious travel do forget thereby. And when I begin to feel decay of might, its strength to me supplies. It cheers my dulled sprite, my spirit. I feel so much better after I've been in fairyland for a while. Okay, this guy's unbelievable. I mean, he's so far out there. Okay, well, he also wrote some sonnets, which don't come close to the Faerie Queen. All right, but here, well, let's take a look at them because I want to make a point. Now, that's it. I think. He wrote a collection of sonnets. Now, Petrarch wrote 400 of these things. Shakespeare wrote 152 of them, these sonnets. Spenser wrote about 70 in a little sequence, and it was called the Amoretti. There's that Etti. That's like little loves. little cupids flying around, and he's writing to a woman. But Spencer is, like I said, so far out there. He writes to a very unusual woman. There's another poet, and I'll go to this. Well, I'll save that for a minute. But what he does is he writes a very simple metaphor. So let's take a look at this, because somebody asked me if I'd do some poetic scansion, and I want to do it now. This is something I know only half of you will get. I'm not going to make a big deal out of it here. I do this regularly in my Shakespeare class, and it just always floors me on the exam. I can never get more than half the people to understand what I'm saying. Okay? I was once interviewing for another position, and they said, can you teach people how to scan, how to put in the accents? And I said, sure, but I was lying. But let's take a look at this line on 1916. Like as a ship that threw the ocean wide. Are you with me? Like, if you're not, write it down as I'm talking. Like as a ship that threw the ocean wide. In English verse, we have stress that gives the beat. The beat is this thing, we use a Greek term, iambic pentameter. And it just means an iamb is a short and then a long, or an unstressed and a stressed syllable. I am, to be or not, to be, right? Unstressed, stress. And that's a unit, and then there's five of those units. So that's why it's called pentameter, because pent is Greek for five, like pentagon, that big building in Washington with five sides. Right? So we all know this. So iambic pentameter is five sets, five iams, and an iam is boom, boom, like your heart, boom, 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 okay? To be or not, to be, that is the question. Right? Now there's a little extra syllable at the end of that line. It doesn't end on the quest, because we have a lot of it. So that just happens, right? We don't need to worry about that. All right. So if we look at this line, like as a ship that threw the ocean wide. Well, if we just think of this theoretically, you can see that the accents are falling on the even syllables, 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10. It's that easy. It can't get any easier. All right. You will know this. I know you will know this. Okay. Like as a ship. So I would underline the word as, or mark it with a stress. No, you don't want to do this, Melinda?
I wrote it
down already. You already did it. But you know this, right? It's not like this. Sometimes think that there's this thing out there that there's a principle for not learning this. As ship. The first word is like. That's number one. The second word is as. That's two. Two is divisible by two, so I call it an even syllable. Right? Three is a. That's a little tiny word. There's no way that's accented. It's very unimportant. Only a fool would accent an unimportant word. That's the key to this whole thing. You accent the important stuff. You write your papers, you put your main idea in the main clause. You write a poem, you put the important words on the accent. Right? To be. Or, not to be. Those are the unimportant words. To be. Ah, whatever that means. Ah, to be. Ophelia. Let us be together. Okay. Right? Ship through osh. Now ocean's real easy. We don't say ocean, we say ocean. The accent is given. The language gives it to us. And you better put the ocean in the right place so it's on an even, so the accent's on an even syllable, in this case the eighth syllable. And then wide is the tenth. So you underline as ship through osh and wide. Like as a ship that threw the ocean wide. Now modern poetry will say, oh, how dull, so regular, 1, 2, 3, 4, where's the rhythm, off the beat, the little jazz thing, right? Spencer's early, we don't need to worry about that. Being on the beat is enough, Okay? This lasts, this regularity lasts right through Shakespeare's middle plays, right through Romeo and Juliet. By about 1604, he'll get tired of the regularity and he'll start jazzing things up really good. Okay? And suddenly there'll be only four beats instead of five, and there'll be all sorts of other stuff. But for the Elizabethan period, we have this regularity, and it's still the backbone of poetry to today, where even if you're not doing meter, you're hearing the missing meter in the back of your head. Okay? There's always a beat going on, even if you're not giving it. But that's not the big point here. The point is simple metaphors. Like as a ship that through the ocean wide, by conduct of some star doth make her way. Right? Where are we? We're in the Renaissance. The big inventions, printing. I forgot to mention, did I mention gunpowder? Big. Okay. That's the definition of the Renaissance. At the beginning of art, you can now blow things up. All right? Which is what we do better than anybody, as my brother says. The one thing America can do, we can blow things up. Man. It's not bad about that. All right? And just to put a little frame on it, there's also, in the Renaissance, is a time of centralization when countries come together, because a cannon, a seriously good cannon that won't melt in battle, is incredibly expensive. All right, so only a major rich city-state can afford a cannon and the guys to get it to the battle and somebody to carry the powder. You know, the casting, the molds were phenomenal. You want to hear about cannons for a minute? What?
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Ariosto, remember Ariosto? He worked for the Duke of Ferrara. Ferrara is a town in Italy, in northern Italy. It's one of these small city-states like Rome, Venice, Milan that made up the Italian peninsula. Florence was another one. Okay. Boccaccio's stories are generally set just south of Ferrara. It's in the Po Valley, just southwest of Venice. But it's a very wealthy state, very artistic, and had great poets. Ariosto being one of them. And he worked for a guy named Duke Alfonso, who had Spanish connections, that's why he's named Alfonso, but he's a duke. And he came into power about 1506. And about the same year, Michelangelo, 10 years after he made the David, well, when the Pope saw that David, they said, who's this guy working up there in Florence? You know, we hate Florence, we're trying to eat them up anyway. And the Pope would send for Michelangelo and make him come down to Rome. And you work for me now. And the Pope at the time was a guy named Julius II, who was the great warrior Pope. Big beard, he spent all his time on a horse. And he had, about that 1506, he conquered Bologna, which is a town in northern Italy. And he went in there, so the papacy controlled a lot of towns in central Italy, and Pope Julius expanded its reach. And now he's got Michelangelo working for him. This is when he does the Sistine Chapel, right? You know, if you watch the movie The Agony and the Ecstasy, he really hated working for the popes. And Julius said, well, I want you to paint the Sistine Chapel. That'll take you 35 years. And also I want you to do my tomb. And my tomb's going to have at least 200 statues, and I want all of them to look like that David. So Michelangelo spent his life making this guy's tomb, but fortunately Julius died in 1512, so it didn't ever get finished. But we have a lot of the unfinished statues. And they're called the Prisoners in Stone. It's just unbelievable to see a half-done Michelangelo statue which he did for Julius. Well, Julius goes into Bologna, and he said, well, now I'm here. This being the Renaissance, it's all about me, right? I may be head of the church, but this is not, he doesn't think this way, but I'm parodying it. But it's the same idea. It's not about the church anymore, it's about me. So, Michelangelo, I want a statue of me right here, right? And I want it big. So Michelangelo spends 2 years casting the largest bronze statue ever cast in the history of the world. He had to invent the furnace. He had to figure out how to melt the copper or whatever, the bronze. He had to make the mold, figure out the process where you make it out of wax. You know, you do a miniature, then you make a big one out of wax, then you find some way to put a plaster thing. You know how you do bronze casting? So he's inventing all this stuff on a massive scale because the bigger you get, you know, things just collapse to their own weight. And by the way, Leonardo da Vinci is doing an equestrian statue in Milan at the same time, which never worked out. So they're actually competing. And he finishes it. He makes this huge bronze bust, just the head of Pope Julius II, which they put outside the main cathedral in Bologna. And it sits there for 6 years, from 1506 to 1512, when Julius dies. Well, then as soon as he dies, the Bolognese, they rise up and they throw out the papal troops and they have a little revolution. And then they're sitting there and it's exactly like Saddam was saying. They pull down the bronze bust, okay? And they say, what are we going to do with all this metal? Well, let's sell it, okay? So there's this huge lump of bronze, all right? And the Duke of Ferrara, who Ariosto's working for, says, I'll buy it, okay? Because we're casting cannon and we don't have enough bronze for the things. All right? And they take the bust of the Pope Julius II, and this is the opposite of beating plowshares into pruning hooks, or pruning, maybe it's the same thing, pruning hooks into plowshares into, what is the biblical thing? Beat plowshares into pruning hooks? Swords into plowshares, something like that. Okay, well they melt down the bust of Julius to make a cannon. And they make two at the same time. One of them is called La Diavola, the devil, in the feminine. And these are the two largest cannon in Europe, and the Ferrarese use them to maintain their defense. And they have enough money to do this, right? The other one is called, and it's still there, you can go to visit it, actually. You know what they call the other one? They seem to give them feminine names, like ships. Juliana. In honor of the Pope, whose bust became the medal for the cannon. This is a true story, okay? Anyway, how did I get onto that?